Shrink Wrap Radio number 302, Exploring Mindful Dreaming with Dr. Ruben Nyman.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
My return guest today after a long absence is Dr. Ruben Nyman, and we'll be discussing his outlook on sleep and dreams. Ruben Nyman, PhD, is a psychologist, clinical assistant professor of medicine, and the sleep and dream specialist at the University of Arizona's Center for Integrative Medicine, directed by Dr. Andrew Weil. He's also director of the Circadian Health Associates, an organization that offers sleep-related services, training, and consultation internationally. For more than a decade, he served as the sleep and dream specialist at Canyon Ranch and Miraval Resorts. Dr. Nyman is a leader in the development of integrative medicine approaches to sleep and dreams, integrating conventional sleep science with depth psychological and spiritual approaches. He's the author of a number of groundbreaking works on sleep, including Healing Night, Healthy Sleep with Dr. Weil, To Sleep Tonight, The Yoga of Sleep, as well as professional book chapters. Now, here's the interview. Dr. Ruben Nyman, welcome back to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you very much. Pleasure to be here.
Well, it's been about a year since I interviewed you on episode number 256 about mindful sleep, mindful dreams. Mm-hmm. And that was a very popular interview, and I think I got so engrossed in what you had to say about sleep that we never really got around to fully exploring the mindful dreaming part. So I'm glad to have you back, and I know my audience will be very appreciative as well. Mm-hmm. So what do you mean by mindful dreaming?
Well, I think we begin with the consideration that dreaming has taken a back seat to waking and to sleep, the other two primary forms of consciousness. You know, even though there still appears to be interest in the dream, if you will, I think there's been sort of an erosion of our understanding of what dreaming is, what the dream is about, and as importantly, there are strong suggestions that as a culture, as a collective, if you will, we're actually dreaming less and less and less. In fact, I think that we are as dream deprived as we are sleep deprived, and it gets very little attention. And I also think the consequences of dream loss, if you will, of dream deprivation, are as significant, as serious in terms of our health, our well-being, our emotional well-being, and our spirituality, as are the consequences of sleep deprivation.
Well, I want to go more into the disadvantages of not dreaming a lot and not dreaming well, but I'm interested in your observation that you think we're dreaming less. I don't think I've encountered that anywhere else, even though I'm a follower of things related to dreams and dreaming. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Is that based on any kind of study or research?
Well, it's based on the following. We know that alcohol is a very commonly used substance, okay? Yeah. And we know that alcohol suppresses REM sleep. Now, a little bit of alcohol is going to result in a little bit of suppression, but for the many people who drink more than recommended amounts, which can be as little as two drinks a night or day for a male and one or more drinks for a female, we know that alcohol interferes with and suppresses REM sleep. More importantly, there's been a pretty dramatic increase and medications that are known to suppress REM sleep. The largest category of these are antidepressants. In fact, there is a model that suggests that one of the activities, one of the sort of principal healing properties of antidepressants is their suppression of REM sleep. So the older antidepressants still in use, the MAO monoamine oxidase inhibitors, can suppress nearly 100% of our dream material. Very significant. The tricyclic antidepressants, TCAs, suppress roughly 50%, still very significant. And the newer antidepressants suppress less, on average about a third of our dreaming, but still a very significant percentage. So antidepressants suppress dreaming. Other medications that are commonly used and also being used in increasing quantities, like benzodiazepines, the Valium, Xanax, Klonopin, Librium-type drugs, also suppress REM sleep. They're often used as sleeping pills, in fact. So there's been public health attention on the fact that we have an increasing anticholinergic burden. This is a reference to using drugs that suppress acetylcholine. In addition to tricyclic antidepressants, for example, as we age, many of the medications commonly used to address issues associated with aging also suppress acetylcholine, which means they're suppressing REM sleep or dreaming. So there's reason to believe that we're dreaming less. From a behavioral standpoint, it's really common, almost ubiquitous, that people terminate their sleep in the morning with an alarm clock. And for many people, it's actually snipping off the tail end of their sleep. Because we spend most of that time in dreaming, we're actually cutting off a portion of our REM sleep every single morning. So these are examples of why I think that. I don't know that anybody's ever done a large-scale study. I doubt that there'd be interest in that. But there's really good reason to believe that we're dreaming less and less.
Well, that's an interesting case that you make, and it would be a very interesting study. What about melatonin and things like that that people take to improve their sleep? Is that a medication that also suppresses dreaming?
No, actually quite the opposite. Melatonin.
I'm sorry, I said melatonin and I misspoke. I meant to say Ambien.
Oh, Ambien. Okay, very different. You know, the data that we have on Ambien is fairly short-term. The so-called long-term data runs only a few weeks. And in that period of time, there was no evidence of REM suppressant. But in the past many years, since Ambien is, of course, the most commonly used sleeping pill in the world, there have been lots and lots of anecdotal reports, substantiated reports, that Ambien is associated with increased automatic behavior at night. So people are getting up and doing things. Most commonly, women are getting up and eating at night, but there are lots of examples of people engaged in other activities, some of them as complex as going outside and driving their cars. There's a very, very good chance that this also represents an interference, some sort of damage associated with the REM sleep process.
Yes, because ordinarily we are paralyzed during our sleep from motoric activity, so it must be interfering with that process.
Right, yeah, very good chance. And I should mention, too, that paralysis, sometimes called sleep paralysis, or more technically, it's called REM atonia, that is REM without muscle tone. Our voluntary muscles normally go offline. There's a condition called REM behavior disorder, or RBD, in which there's a failure of that REM atonia to occur, and people actually are acting out their dreams. And this condition, it appears to be a sort of a prodromal neurodegenerative disease or neurodegenerative process, because a significant percent of people who get this end up with Parkinson's disease or other similar central nervous system disorders. And we've also seen a dramatic increase in REM behavior disorder since the introduction of SSRIs, and they have been linked. SSRI use has been linked to increases in RBD.
Now, this is just a little bit tangential, but since we're talking about Ambien, I know there are accounts of people who flipped out on airplanes. I know that I take Ambien when I'm flying to Europe and coming back because I want to be able to sleep. But I've read rather disturbing reports of airline passengers who've just gone bonkers
Yeah, well, Ambien and other similar non-benzodiazepine sleeping pills or hypnotics are associated with something called anterior grade amnesia. So there's a chance, a decent chance, that from the moment you pop that Ambien, once it takes effect, till the moment you fall asleep, you'll have little or no memory of what's gone on. And that period of time can also be associated with disinhibition. So people can act out, and it's a little bit like an alcohol blackout, and they won't remember what happened. In fact, while we're on that, I don't recall if we talked about this last time, but one of the primary actions of sleeping pills is that I actually think we shouldn't call them sleeping pills, that we should call them anti-waking pills. Mm-hmm. And there's a difference between the suppression of waking, which is what they do, and the promotion of sleep. They don't directly promote sleep. When you look closely at the data, there was a good meta-analytic study done in 2007 by the National Institute of Health, and it found that the decrease in sleep onset latency, meaning the amount of time it takes you to fall asleep, was really minimal, and the increase in total sleep time was also very minimal. It turns out that what most sleeping pills do is that they interfere with memory formation for poor or fragmented sleep. In other words, if we give you a sleeping pill and you wake up the next day and you say, "My, that was refreshing," if we had monitored your sleep through the night with objective measures, with polysomnography, it would turn out that you didn't sleep nearly as well as you thought. But the sleeping pill interfered with the formation of memory around poor sleep. So it's a little bit like taking a painkiller for a broken bone and saying, "Well, you know, this feels fine. I don't need a cast on it." I think it's a very, very serious problem that the public needs to be aware of. You're not getting sleep on sleeping pills.
Okay.
It's anti-waking.
Now, we know that we feel bad if we're sleep deprived, but you've made the point that we're at a disadvantage if we're dream deprived.
Yes.
Say something about that. What are the effects of not? Well, are we in fact dream deprived, or is it that just we're not remembering dreams because we know those are somewhat separate issues?
Well, yeah, there are actually three issues here. One is, first of all, REM sleep and dreaming they overlap significantly, but they're not synonymous. And maybe we'll talk about this more. There's evidence that we dream. We have different kinds of dreams during different kinds of sleep. And I would actually add that there is a kind of dreaming that happens off and on through the day that the Jungians refer to as the waking dream. But when we're REM deprived, we are actually, it's not just a matter of not remembering dreams. It's reducing the openness, if you will, to that kind of dreaming. So I believe there is an absolute reduction in the amount of dreaming we're having now. Now, dreaming is critical for the formation of certain types of memory, particularly procedural memory, for certain types of learning. And there's really strong evidence that dreaming it supports our emotional healing. And so the less we dream, the less of that we have. There's also some evidence that dream recall can help with emotional healing.
Yeah, that's interesting. I'm thinking of Jungian psychology, and of course, dreams play an important role in that approach.
Mm-hmm.
But what you're saying suggests, and of course, in the Jungian approach, it's very important to understand your dreams, that is going to be the thing that contributes to emotional healing.
Mm-hmm.
You seem to suggest that there's healing whether we recall or understand our dreams.
I think so. I think there's a kind of processing that goes on. Now, understanding our dreams, dream interpretation is another really interesting topic. And I think one of the big benefits of that is a kind of what I think of as sort of a spiritual self-efficacy. It can deepen our sense of trust or faith in our own unconscious.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very important. There is a kind of healing that happens, I think, independently of whether or not we're consciously aware of it. I think of dreaming as a kind of an information digestion process. So during waking life, we consume lots of information. Obviously, some of it from reading material or listening to people speak, but just information, all the sensory information that's input in our waking lives, the things that we see, the things that we sense. It's a little bit like consuming food and fluids. You know, we eat during the day, and of course, what we eat is digested, and then in the body's wisdom, it makes decisions. It screens in and screens out. It decides that this material is going to be excreted, and this material is going to be kept and assimilated. So I think the brain does something similar, the mind, the psyche does something similar with all of the information that we consume during the day. Some of it is let go of. And then the rest of it becomes assimilated. And I think that assimilation happens during dreaming. Particularly in the early part of the night, that information is integrated with the rest of who we are.
I love that concept of information digestion, and the way that you've explained it really is very compelling. Now, earlier you mentioned a relationship between sleep and depression. And maybe you can talk about that a bit.
Yeah, I actually think more specifically there's a relationship between dream loss and depression. It's interesting, if you selectively deprive experimental subjects of REM sleep, of dreaming, and this has been done both with animals, number of studies with animals and with humans, the REM sleep bounces back. It's called a REM rebound. Now, bear in mind that generally, in a normal sleep process, we get most of our deep or stage sleep in the first part of the night. Little bits of REM sleep coming up then, but mostly we sleep in the first part of the night and we dream in the last part of the night. And what happens then, if you allow an experimental subject to get all the sleep it needs, literally the stage sleep, but you set up an experiment to suppress the REM sleep, that REM sleep will start to push back, and it starts to rebound. And in fact, it begins to show up very early in the sleep cycle. It's under pressure, and this is referred to as a reduced REM latency. So the amount of time it typically takes for REM to show, even the first REM is usually about 90 minutes, but you start to see REM showing up in 60 minutes, 30 minutes. Sometimes you get a sleep onset REM. Wow. So it's under so much pressure. Now that pattern of reduced REM latency is the single most common pattern of sleep we see in individuals with clinical mood disorders. It looks like the common sleep we see with serious anxiety and depressive disorders. So in one sense, people who are depressed look like they've lost their dreams. Now, when I was in training years ago, I was taught that depression is a loss of one's dreams. Now, that statement was metaphoric, but it seems to me there may be a pretty significant literal underpinning to that we lose our dreams. It makes sense. If I can jump to another perspective here, I'm thinking of a R.D. Lang poem, a very short poem that I think really is a beautiful invitation into the dream. He wrote, "The range of what we think and do is limited by what we fail to notice. And because we fail to notice that we fail to notice, there's little we can do to change until we notice how failing to notice shapes our thoughts and deeds." Mm-hmm. So this conveys a sense that there's more to our consciousness. And I think when we look closely at dreaming, we come to realize that dreaming, in fact, is a kind of waking. So I think of dreaming as the same as waking. Imagine, for example, if consciousness was flowing water. When that water is contained and directed by the banks, by banks, it becomes a river. When those banks dissolve into the coast, into a sea or an ocean, the water becomes an ocean or a sea. So in waking life, consciousness, if you will, in waking life, is framed by, it's constrained and framed and directed by both sensory input, you know, what we're seeing and hearing, smelling, tasting, touching in the world, and motor output. It's, in other words, consciousness is embodied and it's shaped. The riverbanks of consciousness in waking life are made up of sensory input and motor output. At night, when we go to sleep, the first thing we do is we relinquish sensory input. We close our eyes. It's about 80% of sensory stimulation is visual. They've not yet been discovered, but I have a theory that we have ear lids. we stop hearing. The only sense that seems to remain somewhat active through the night is olfaction, that we can smell. But by and large, we give up on sensory input in the first part of the night when we're sleeping. In the latter part of the night, we add to that rematonia. We get sleep paralyzed. So dreaming is waking that is not framed or constrained or grounded, if you will, by the body, by its sensory input and motor output. So I think it's the same consciousness. It's the same water, if you will, the same flow in a different context.
You come up with great metaphors, and I like that theoretical structure that you just outlined for us. Now, you've talked about insomnia, and that it's not just an inability to sleep, but you've described it as excessive hyperarousal, and that was kind of a new idea for me.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think this relates very much to dreaming as well. There's an interesting counterpoint between dreaming and waking. So here's let me come to your question in a roundabout way, if I may. There's this classic sort of story about consciousness and unconsciousness, and that's that fish don't believe in water. Maybe you've heard this.
Sure.
You know, so because not until, I mean, if you go up to a fish and say, hey, you know, you're not going to believe this, but there's this thing, it's all around you. You live in it, you breathe in it, you swim in it, you sleep in it, and you can't see it or feel it, you habituate to it, the fish is going to go, right. But, you know, so the story is not until one fish happens to sort of venture toward the surface, the top of the water, and leap out and get out of the water for a second. Not until that happens does the fish realize that there's something called unwater. You have to get that there is unwater before you can recognize water. I think people need to really get, they need to leap into the unconscious, and this is in large part the dream, before they can really understand waking consciousness. Most people don't get waking. So we live in a wake-centric world. We presume that waking is it. You know, this is it. And the way our culture encourages us to do waking is about focusing on really literal, rational, linear, active, productive, sort of speedy consciousness. You know, it's the bullet train of consciousness.
Right.
And so this takes us to hyperarousal. Most of us realize that we sleep at different stages or different levels. There can be lighter sleep, deeper sleep, and very deep sleep. Most of us don't realize, and this is based on EEG studies, that we also are awake at different levels. So we can be a little bit awake. Most obviously, when we're getting up in the morning, we're groggy, or maybe before sleep at night, we're probably half awake, half asleep. We can be moderately awake, or we can be very awake. And this is represented in EEG most typically by different levels of beta activity. You know, so beta waves can be sort of low level and they can go way up. It can also include some alpha activity. Of course, we can be so deeply relaxed and waking that there's alpha activity. And this combination of beta, alpha, and alpha, theta is that sort of in-between zone, the continuum, if you will, between waking and sleep. But we can be we can achieve high levels of waking. And I think it's encouraged strongly, you know, in our culture. It's a little bit like an airplane taking off. You know, a single-engine plane can fly a few hundred feet above the ground, or 1,000 feet, or 3,000 or 4,000 feet above the ground. A lot of people fly really high and really fast. So it's kind of a high-level waking. When this becomes persistent, it's known as hyperarousal. And hyperarousal is it has been studied extensively. It's associated with elevated heart rate, elevated and displaced cortisol, reductions in melatonin, increased beta EEG, sort of a chronic activation of the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis. So it's as if the whole body-mind system is hyped. You know, this is sort of high-level buzzing consciousness, if you will. Now, I think it's fine to achieve that kind of consciousness, but we also need to be able to descend from it and, if you will, come back to the ground, land, have a long enough runway so that we can slow down, brake, stop, and rest again. But a lot of people who are hyper-aroused actually have this elevated metabolic process around the circadian cycle, both day and night. And it's as if they never really reset themselves. And I think, I suspect that this is theoretic, that this is also associated with the loss of dreaming. Part of the reason I say that is, you know, most of us are aware of circadian cycles, that there's this large 24-hour loop that includes waking and sleeping, waking and sleeping, waking and sleeping, is the yin-yang. Most people aren't aware that there's a smaller cyclic process. These are ultradian rhythms. Specifically, there's one called BRAC. I don't know if you're familiar with that, Dave. BRAC.
No,
so BRAC stands for Basic Rest and Activity Cycle. It's something that's been known for over 30 years, and it's interesting to me that the general public hasn't keyed into this. So a BRAC cycle runs on average about 90 minutes. So these are 90-minute cycles that go 24 hours a day. At night, they're sleep cycles, which in each cycle includes some degree of deep sleep and some degree of REM. As I said earlier, the proportions change through the night. But during the day, what happens in a BRAC cycle, roughly, again, on average 90 minutes, is the dominant brain hemisphere is active for approximately 70 minutes for bulk of the cycle. When I say active, for most of us, it's sort of left brain consciousness. We're focused, we're linear, we're attentive, we're productive, we're linguistic, we're rational. You know, we're in that state of mind. And you can see this in various brain studies, that dominant hemisphere starts to rest. It actually quiets down. And the non-dominant hemisphere lights up. Two sides of the brain take turns. And the non-dominant hemisphere, for most of us, the right hemisphere, as it lights up, we shift consciousness. We become less focused, a little less linear, a lot less linear, more dispersed. It's a visual spatial, almost a dreamy kind of consciousness. And I've come to believe that actually this is a pulsation of dreamlike activity that's coming up during the day. At this moment, when the dominant hemisphere is quieting, the artist in us is stepping back from the details of the painting. We're stepping back from the trees, and we're beginning to sense the forest, the bigger picture. It takes us into a more creative realm. Now, when this happens, there is a sense of a loss of energy. We might want to stretch. We might want to get up and use the restroom. I think there's a common unconscious tendency to want to mood alter at this point. I think people will, you know, go for a cup of coffee or, you know, a piece of pound cake or something. But I think there's this natural pulsation between this focused, attentive, productive consciousness, you know, typical waking, and then this dreamy consciousness that arises repeatedly through the day. The great hypnotherapist Milton Erickson keyed into this. You know, he would typically see his patients for a 90-minute period, and during that period, he was assured that he could follow somebody through an entire cycle independently of where he started. And he geared his therapy, particularly his hypnosis, to his sense of where that individual was in that process. So the point of all this is that I think dreamlike consciousness emerges during the day repeatedly, but we tend, in a culture that is so focused on productivity and being aroused and hyper-aroused, you know, excessive wakefulness, if you will, we tend to override the dream during the day.
Wow. that was quite a wrap. That's really good. I have to think about that one. And the whole BRAC thing and the relationship to REM is fascinating to think about. I know I've always felt that we have some kind of what Freud called primary process thinking at one point, that beneath the roots of our conscious thoughts, there's some level of mentation going on that percolates up into consciousness, but there's also, you know, aspects of it that don't percolate. And then to relate that to this sort of scientific understanding of how the brain is cycling through these circadian rhythms is fascinating.
Yeah. You know, Freud also said that dreaming is the royal road to the unconscious, and it's an interesting notion, and I think it reflects some sort of deep-seated bias in consciousness. So for Freud, when somebody brought him a dream, the dream had to be interpreted because it didn't make sense in consciousness. And the presumption, and this is a widespread presumption today, is that the dream was there primarily to help us better understand waking life. Now, there's a common bias, I think, in consciousness today that really impedes our becoming more integrated from a consciousness standpoint. And the bias is, I think I alluded to this earlier, we are wake-centric. We see waking consciousness as the gold standard for consciousness. It's a little bit like the pre-Copernican days, you know, when everybody knew that the Earth was the center of the universe. And Copernicus stood up and said, well, wait a minute, and nearly got himself killed for saying, you know, there are other worlds out there. Yeah. And so we see waking as the center of consciousness, and therefore we look at both sleep and dreaming, the two other kinds of consciousness, as servants of waking. They're subservient to waking. So, for example, you know, when we look at sleep research, pretty much all sleep research asks, how can you, sleep, help us be better waking people? And, of course, sleep answer says, well, in lots of ways, you know. Sleep improves memory, it improves stamina, it improves immunity, it improves your appearance, and on and on. And we do the same thing with dreaming. We presume that the dream is there as a servant of waking life. And I just want to stress, there's no question that dreams can help us understand ourselves better. I mean, in very dramatic ways. But setting dream consciousness up as secondary to waking is a problem. And so this has been a tradition in psychology forever. I think James Hillman tried to shake this up a little bit. But again, Freud would say, you know, we have to interpret the dream. It's the royal road to the unconscious. I think the dream is the unconscious. We're already there. And we just don't like the way it looks because it doesn't really match up with waking consciousness. So we want to reinterpret it. In one sense, it downsizes the dream so that we can fit it into our conceptualizations of waking life.
What if we, based on that, what if we kind of turn things on their head and say, how must I lead my life, to my conscious life, to better support my dreaming?
Right. I think that's a great question. Well, you know, here's the other thing, Dave. I think that the loss of dreaming throws us into a kind of mundane living. You know, for many, many people, life has lost its enchantment. You know, it's rather flat and gray. It's a rat race, you know. There's limited joy during the day. You know, that depression and dysphoria are epidemic in our world today. And so I think part of it is that we've lost this broader sense. We fail to notice the bigger picture of our lives. Because dreaming and waking are really the same consciousness. But again, in our tendency to segregate the two and see the dream as subservient, we miss the waking dream. You know, we miss the presence of elements of dreaming in waking life. We just stop paying attention to them because they're not functional, right?
Yeah. One of the things I had planned to ask you about further along, but since it's come up now, is about lucid dreaming. And I know that people who are very versed in and fond of lucid dreaming urge us to look at waking consciousness as a kind of dream,
right,
and to become more lucid during our waking lives.
Right, right. I think that's a great idea. I think most people have at least some moments of lucidity in their dreams. It's probably most evident during a bad dream. So yeah. All of us have had bad dreams, nightmares, and then there's a moment where even with our eyes closed, even immersed in the dream, we suddenly have a sense that our head is on the pillow, that we're in bed, and we get a wave of relief. It's like, oh my God, it's just a dream.
Right.
And it's so interesting. In that moment, I think of this as something I call the verge. Once there's a recognition that the dream is just a dream, we can be emboldened because we know it's a dream. Knowing it's a dream means we will awaken from it. Because we know that, we can actually go back into the dream, even into a bad dream, you know, with impunity. It's like it's safe now to do this. So a lot of people experience lucidity in that way. There's another kind of lucidity in which you're dreaming and you're co-conscious. So you know that you're dreaming, and it can create a profound sense of freedom. You know, I can direct the dream. I can do what I want. And a lot of the sort of Western world-based psychology, scientific-based studies and interest, even anecdotal interest in lucid dreaming, is really about taking control of the dream. It's not a surprise because we're kind of fond of control in the Western world. And that's in contrast to Tibetan Buddhist sleep and dream yogas. Now this is a sort of a very elaborate, complex teaching in Tibetan Buddhism, a very difficult path, but there's a whole literature in Tibetan Buddhism on sleep and dreams and using it for spiritual growth. And what I want to say about that is they have a very different posture toward lucidity. They actually teach lucidity, but they discourage the dreamer from changing the dream. They want the dreamer to observe the dream and observe and observe and observe, and then over time, they want the dreamer to observe the dreamer. it gets a little Zen-ish here. You know what's interesting? Freud used to say that the fully analyzed individual stops dreaming, you know, presumably because the unconscious is settled at that point and there's no need to dream. And I think for very different reasons, the Tibetans say the fully enlightened soul actually stops dreaming too. But that's because they're no longer caught in producing, you know, karmic traces. But I'm personally a little bit cautious around lucidity. I don't think it's a game we should play with. I think we're dealing with consciousness issues, and I believe it ought to be approached primarily from a spiritual perspective and not from a partying perspective.
Yeah, that's an interesting point, and I haven't heard it expressed in quite that way. I know that sometimes people raise the concern, well, if you try to control your dreams, aren't you going to be blocking the unconscious messages that you need to be receiving to be healing? And my response to that has been, well, you don't have that much control. It seems like the unconscious will have its way.
Yeah, there are some cases where people appear to have a lot of control, And in fact, they so enjoy their dream lives that they're reluctant to spend time in the waking world. You know, they want to dream whenever they can.
Yeah.
It's an interesting skill, although I think it can be a distraction if we're not careful.
Okay. I was reading a couple of your blog posts that you sent to me, and one passage that I outlined, you talk about fatigue, and I underlined a passage, which I'll quote right now. Depressed individuals tend to be less sleepy by day than expected, but substantially more fatigued. Mm-hmm. Fatigue is the most common sign of depression presented in primary care, accounting for more than 10 million outpatient office visits per year in the U.S. alone.
Yeah.
Fatigue is also the most troublesome residual symptom that persists after treatment with antidepressants. Common sense notwithstanding, fatigue is not caused by a simple lack of sleep, but by chronic excessive wakefulness. And I guess that fits with what you've been saying. How does one treat fatigue? What do you do if what's going on?
So another a theory that I've had about fatigue is certainly not all fatigue, but a lot of it stemmed from my work as a consultant in a chronic fatigue clinic for 5 years with Dr. Jesse Stoff, who'd written the first book on chronic fatigue syndrome. And so here's another way of looking at fatigue. When we dream, and we go into REM atonia, you might look at that loss of muscle tone as being extreme, total, complete fatigue. At that point, you literally can't move, so it's extreme fatigue. You know, we know that when dreaming is suppressed at night, if it's suppressed extensively over a period of time, dreamlike mentation will rebound into waking life. For example, if sleeping is suppressed, sleep will show up in waking life as sleepiness. If dreaming is suppressed, the dream aspects of dream mentation can show up in waking life as dreaminess. Mm-hmm. And not in any romantic sense. It's pathological because you can't really think straight, and it can involve hallucinations or delusions. The other part, the physical part of the dream, when dreaming is lost, I think can rebound into waking life as fatigue. And again, this is all anecdotal, but I used to recommend to my chronic fatigue patients that they do something that they were so resistant to doing. And actually, I recommend this to depressed patients as well. I recommend rest, that they actually rest during the day. And this is abhorrent to lots of people. You know, for one thing, rest looks like depression, you know, because, my God, you could be doing something. Why are you lying there? A lot of people confuse fatigue with sleepiness. When they're fatigued, they try to sleep, but they're different needs. And we now, there are new scales have been developed over the past few years, and we know that fatigue is an independent construct from sleep, from sleepiness. So I think fatigue, one way of looking at fatigue is it's a call to return to the waking dream. So there's a low level of fatigue-like experience that comes at the end of the Brack cycle when the dominant hemisphere quiets down. We actually we lose a little bit of energy, if you will. We get a little bit, maybe fatigue is too strong a word, but it pulls us into rest. It's called the basic rest and activity cycle, Brack. Basic rest and activity. It's the rest part we have trouble with. When we rest, and this is not sleep, but when we rest cyclically by day, I think we're drawn into the dream, and I think that can help us heal fatigue.
Okay. And so what's the relationship between dreaming and depression then? Is it that depressed people are not dreaming?
I think so. I think, you know, in a metaphoric sense, depression is a loss of dreams. It's a loss of that natural tendency of consciousness to expand. You know, it's like taking off a pair of tight shoes and your foot goes, you know, it's about taking off a tight body, you know, a tightly focused sensorium, a tightly focused muscles around doing things. So it's about relaxing consciousness. And this is not in contrast, I'm not suggesting we don't be active and productive. It's a complement to it. Let me give you an example. So if we compare experience in the dream to to waking life. You know, let's say we're going somewhere, we're running a little late for some kind of appointment or lecture or something, and you're walking along the sidewalk, and you know, very commonly, I'm thinking about, like, you know, walking down the street in Manhattan, you'll see a pigeon feather or something on the sidewalk. Now, I was taught as a little boy not to touch that because it had germs, you know.
Right.
But you're rushing along, you don't even notice it. But let's switch, and now we go from a waking scene to a dream, and you're in a dream and you're going somewhere and it feels important and you're walking along and suddenly you notice a feather on the sidewalk. Now, that same feather, when it appears in a dream, it appears with a sense of meaning. Like, you're on the phone with your therapist later that day saying, you know, there was a feather in my dream. What does it mean? So the contrast between waking and dreaming is this. In waking life, pretty much everything is presumed meaningless unless it's aligned with my intentions. So waking life is driven by intention. And intention, it delimits my attentiveness, my focus, my actions. So in waking life, everything is meaningful if it's aligned with my intention. If it's not, it's barely noticed. In dream life, everything is meaningful. There's a sense of open-heartedness. And I think the loss of that openness, the openness to mystery, it's a kind of dance with life where you're not solely defining what's meaningful in life, but you're also listening to life, and life is showing up in meaningful ways. So there's a presumption of meaning in the dream.
Well, that relates to something that you've talked. You sometimes use the phrase that dreaming is like yoga for the soul.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, dreaming stretches consciousness. It allows us to stretch out. You know, when we've been sitting, for example, at a desk for too long, we want to get up and stretch our arms and legs and back and neck and so on physically. I think it's similar with the dream. You know, when our consciousness has been constricted and focused on being productive and analytic for a long time, it needs to stretch. It needs to go into the non-rational, you know, into the dream.
Yes, and, you know, you say, and I believe this as well, that people who dream well, that's interesting, the idea that some people don't dream well and some mm-hmm. people do dream well, that people who dream well have an advantage when it comes to healing, that they heal faster. I believe that. Do you have evidence for that?
No, I think it's theoretic. But I think that dreaming is as critical as sleep. You know, we've been surprised in the last couple of decades with all of this research telling us what our grandparents knew, that sleep is important to our physical and mental health. We haven't gotten there with dreaming. You know, I'm a member of the American Academy of Sleep Medicine, and I'm forever thinking, you know, it should be the American Academy of Sleep and Dream Medicine. Mm-hmm. And I actually made this recommendation in a publication I'm working on, and it annoyed some people. And it's simply because dreaming is seen as a stepchild. But I think we'll come to learn that dreaming is not just a psychological tool to help us enhance our insight. It's something that is deeply healing. It's a natural aspect of consciousness that affects us physically and mentally and spiritually.
Here's another good turn of phrase that you wrote that I really liked, that just as bad feelings can be part of a good life, bad dreams can be part of a good dream life.
Yeah, I think that's so important. I've actually been in some talks with some people at the Department of Defense, and, you know, most of us are aware now that we have, you know, so many thousands and thousands and thousands of wounded warriors coming back from the front.
Yes.
And, you know, a significant percentage of them develop post-traumatic stress disorder, and the bulk of those folks, one of the major symptoms they contend with are horrific repetitive nightmares. I did some training at Walter Reed about a year ago, actually, on alternative approaches to dealing with nightmares. So here's what's interesting, culture-wide, and certainly in conventional medicine and military medicine, the nightmare is seen as a symptom of pathology. It's seen as something that is a reflection of an underlying mental disease, and it needs to be gotten rid of. And so the most common treatments by far involve using REM suppressant medications. The big one is something called Prozacin, which is an alpha blocker. It's also used as a blood pressure medication, but basically it suppresses dreaming. It pushes the symptoms away. Now, what most people don't mention is as soon as you stop taking that, you're going to get a massive rebound of those symptoms. It just dams them up. It doesn't process it. But here's the thing. There's such a lack of trust in the dreaming process, and particularly when it's a bad dream, when it's a nightmare. And, you know, there's some cross-culture data that suggests that probably two-thirds of the emotions that appear in dreams are negative emotions. Mm-hmm. You know, and we might say that you know, two-thirds of dreams are maybe bad dreams. It often gets me wondering, like, about what percentage of waking emotion is bad, you know?
Yeah.
I think it could be just as high, if not higher.
Sure.
But the tendency to look at the nightmare and to look at a bad dream as being pathological is a huge mistake. It's based on a mistrust of our innate capacity to heal. And integrative medicine, Dr. Weil emphasizes that we need to remember that healing is endogenous, that our bodies, our minds, our spirits are really designed to heal. And they're, you know, we can trust. The big example is a fever. In our world, you know, most people think of a fever as a sign of illness. Well, often it's an indication that there's illness there, but the fever per se is actually a healing process. It's an endogenous healing process. So I think of depression in general. I think of depression as a psychological fever, that so many of the symptoms of depression, in particular the desire to rest, and I believe the desire to, if we allow it to go into a waking dream, that it's an endogenous healing process, that we can trust it. Now, of course, there are extremes to this, and if somebody is suicidal or you know, has a severe psychomotor depression, that's something else. But most depression does not look like that. And likewise, I think we need to take another look at the nightmare and treat it with respect, treat it with regard, and recognize that we can work with it to help an individual heal. We don't have to be afraid of it.
Well, have you come up with your own approach then to dealing with PTSD for returning warriors?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's my own. It's more, it's a mix of approaches. It's what I call an integrative approach. And basically, it looks at the individual in terms of body, mind, and spirit. And based on integrative medicine principles, it considers a lot of the symptomatic processes being signs of endogenous healing. So it's about not using suppressive therapies whenever they can be avoided. There's really good, there are two basic approaches that I integrate, and one of them is based on recent studies of imagery rehearsal. There are ways of helping people make conscious changes to the narrative of their dream, facing the dream, and in a sense reintegrated into their waking lives. And I couple this with more of a sort of a classic approach to dreaming. Many people are familiar with Asclepius, who was the Greek god of healing and medicine, and really this was the foundation of Western medicine. And in antiquity, when people were troubled or ill, they would go to an Asclepian temple, and the primary treatment involved their spending the night there. They would do ritual to incubate, to encourage dreaming, and in the morning they would sit with a dream priest or dream specialist and use that dream, look at that dream as a part of the healing process. So I think what I look at is a combination of the best of the old and the new. The new being this evidence-based imagery rehearsal therapy, and the old being a posture toward dreaming that has a very deep regard for its endogenous healing capacity.
Okay, well, as we begin to wind down here, I wanted to ask you about your take on dreaming and psi, for example, you know, psychic phenomena such as precognitive dreams.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, big question. Good question. You know, I was taught by the man I study dreaming with that nothing happened in the waking world before it happened in the dream world.
Who was that, by the way, that you studied with?
Yeah, you know, he was a shamanic practitioner, so I'm going to kind of keep him a little on the private side for now.
Okay.
But here's the way I think about it. You know, when we look up into the night sky, and we see a star or a constellation that may be 100 light years away. We're seeing it now. We're seeing it today. But we know that what we're seeing is really the past, that it started 100 years ago and it just arrived here. What we're seeing has already happened. And what I was taught was that waking life was like that experience. By the time things happened in the waking world, they had already occurred in the dream world. Now, if that's the case, and in our dreams we have the freedom to ascend, for example, into the heights of consciousness, we can actually experience the light of that star, metaphorically, as it's coming to the earth. When we wake up, we're back in this world, and when that light appears, we might have had a precognitive sense. We might have a sense of a deja vu about it. It's like, well, I've seen this before, depending on the amount of awareness we've retained from that experience. So this is one metaphor that explains it, and I can't argue that there's any kind of scientific truth to that. But the one thing that dreaming does for me is it reminds me that everything we know really shrinks in comparison to this huge, mysterious context that it floats in.
Well, that's a great place for us to wrap it up. Dr. Reuben Nyman, I want to thank you for being my guest again today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Oh, always a pleasure. Thank you very much.
Wow, I think Dr. Reuben Nyman is a great guest. I hope you feel the same. I think he has a really original turn of mind. And as you heard, I love the metaphors he comes up with. For example, the idea that dreaming represents information digestion. Also the notion that insomnia is a form of hyperarousal, and his river metaphor for waking versus sleeping consciousness. And there were others that I'm now having trouble remembering. I really hope someone will step forward to transcribe this one, which will help with my memory issue, because I'd really like to be able to refer back to the many ideas he brought forth. Reuben works closely with Dr. Andrew Weil in his integrative medicine approach. I've tried to get Andrew Weil, but apparently he's beyond the reach of little old me. Be that as it may, I'm so glad to have access to Reuben Nyman because I think he's a professional of similar stature, which is why I'm sure he's on Dr. Weil's team. Reuben shared with me that he recently did a workshop on integrative mental health. I'm looking forward to inviting him back on the show sometime in the future to share that work with us. Let me know if you'd like to hear more of Dr. Reuben Nyman as well.
Like what you hear? Show your appreciation by making a donation to keep this life-changing podcast up and running. Simply go to the Shrink Wrap Radio website and click on the big green donate button and show Dr. Dave some love.
Thank you, Sherry West, for that lovely and professional request for support. And thank you, all of those of you who have clicked on that big green donate button already. Hey, I'm happy to announce that we have a new transcript up on the site. It's episode 298 on positive psychology and health outcomes with Dr. Lisa Aspinwall. You'll recall that that's a really good one for all of those of you interested in the pros and cons of positive psychology. I'm in the process of trying to figure out Google Plus. If you are on Google Plus, please add me to one of your circles, pretty please. I will create a circle for Shrink Wrap Radio listeners, and maybe we can even get together in a video hangout on Google Plus. I'm going to be doing a presentation about Google Plus at a conference in October, and I need to become an expert between now and then. How do I keep getting myself into these challenges? And speaking of Google Plus, there is a plus one button on our site in the right-hand sidebar. And right now, we only show 5+ recommendations, and getting a lot more would help our ranking on Google. So please go to the site and plus us. And while you're there, notice that you can make all your Amazon.com purchases through our widget there in the right-hand sidebar. And you'll also find a link to our Yahoo discussion group, which could use some more energy. And don't forget to look at all our CE course units, that is continuing education courses that you can earn mostly for just listening. And check out our apps tab for information on how to get our iPhone and Android apps. And if you're not already subscribed to Shrink Wrap Radio on iTunes, it doesn't cost you anything, and you can do that too. And perhaps leave us a positive review there if you like what you're hearing.
Hi, this is Dr. Jeffrey Raff, Jungian analyst and author, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
Thanks, Dr. Jeffrey Raff, who will be my return guest on the next episode. More about that in a bit. First, let's listen to a few emails from our Shrink Wrap Radio listener community. First, we hear from Andrew, who writes, "Hello, Dr. Dave. I'm a doctoral student in counseling psychology, currently in exile or sabbatical, depending upon how you choose to look at it. Due to the current internship imbalance, I'm currently ABI, that is all but internship. So I'm taking a bit of a break. In this time, I'm trying to stay sharp, and one thing I'm doing is listening to your podcasts." All right, I like that idea. He goes on to say, "I have listened to 200 through 270 already in the past 6 weeks and have just recently discovered your Wise Counsel podcast. I've enjoyed listening to your interviews with Drs. Yalom, Beck, Greenberg, and Foa there. I'm a student member of the APA Division 51, Society for the Psychological Study of Men and Masculinity, and wondered if you've looked into interviewing anyone on this topic. This is a fascinating field that grew not as a reaction to feminism, but really out of feminism. It examines the socialized role of men and investigates how many of the socialized roles and expectations of men are directly harmful to them, both psychologically and physiologically. When people ask why I study this, my opening line is this, quotes, 'Depending on which statistics you use, men die on average 5 to 7 years earlier than women. Considering that our biology is built to last just as much as theirs, you ever wonder why that is?'" End quote. Some great people to interview would be Mark Kesalika, I'm not sure I'm saying that, at the College of New Jersey, James O'Neill at the University of Connecticut, Ron Levant, University of Akron, Fred Rabinowitz at the University of Redlands, or Aaron Rocklin, University of Texas, Sam Busser, University of Houston, Glenn Good, University of Missouri, etc. You can also visit the Division 51 website at www.division51.org. I hope this is helpful, and I look forward to hearing from you. Keep up the excellent work. And that's from Andrew, and he is in Texas, in Lubbock, Texas. Andrew, thanks so much for writing, and I'm so glad that you've chosen this way of keeping your mind sharp. I think that's a great idea. And I'm sorry to hear that you're stranded on the island of no internship. I know that can be challenging in these days when so many people are majoring and getting doctoral degrees in psychology and counseling, and the internships can be somewhat sparse. I wonder if you've listened to my interview with Jed Diamond on Shrink Wrap Radio. That's the one that's closest to your topic. And I appreciate your suggestion about people to interview, and I will definitely keep that in mind. And I think your topic is a really good one. And, you know, I've just sort of accepted the figures that men die early without questioning them too closely. And so if there's good reason for disputing that and perhaps extending our lifespans, I'm all for it. Okay, moving right along. Next, we hear from Judy, who writes, I love, love, love your podcasts and enjoy listening to them on my iPod in my car as I'm driving. Is there a way to download to my iPod the earlier podcasts? I've only been able to stream them on the computer. Thank you. And that comes from Judy. Judy, there are probably a number of tricks for doing what you want to do. It's certainly possible. And I don't know what kind of computer you have, whether you have a Mac or Windows. And I think things generally are easier on the Mac in terms of coordinating with your iPod. I may be a bit I'm more than a bit prejudiced on that score. You can get to, you know, on iTunes, it shows the most recent 75 episodes. And if you want to, so subscribing in iTunes is the easiest way to get them onto your iPad, or iPod rather, if you sync your iPod with iTunes. If you're going back further than 75 shows, then you can do that from our site, because all of the shows are available on our site. And you go to the episode that you want to record, and then there are a couple of little places there. I'm not looking at it right now, but I think it says download this podcast. If you right-click on it or control-click, there is an option that allows you to save it to your hard drive. Once you've got it saved on your hard drive, you need to figure out how to wrestle it into iTunes or to get it onto your iPod, which is probably what you're asking me how to do. And it's a little complicated to explain here, but it's definitely possible. It's something that I've done. You somehow get it into a playlist, and you got to find a friend who's kind of Mac savvy, I would say, or go to an Apple store and have them walk you through it. I'm hoping you're motivated enough to keep at it. Finally, we hear from Veronica in London, who replies to my thanks for her donation. And she writes, hello, Dr. Dave. Thank you for the great podcast! Exclamation point. It's really just a small donation in comparison with such huge volume of interesting and well-crafted content you give us. I do live in London, but I'm actually from Brazil. I'm always encouraging my Brazilian friends to listen to your awesome podcast. Yes, please do keep the soul food coming. Cheers, Veronica. And Veronica, hey, thanks for letting your Brazilian friends know. Maybe we can somehow combine it with the Olympics somehow and make listening to Shrink Wrap Radio for Brazilians an Olympic-related event. So I think that better wrap it up for today. As always, send your emails to me, shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. Also, be sure to leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. Leave voicemails on Skype, where I'm ShrinkPod, and you can leave voicemail on our phone. Haven't had anybody do that in an awful long time, at 206-337-0622, or you can get hold of our iPhone app or Android app by going to the apps tab in shrinkwrapradio.com and downloading that app, and then you can leave messages pretty directly. So thank you to my guest, Dr. Ruben Nyman, for all he shared with us on mindful dreaming. He's a great guest, as always, and I look forward to having him on the show again in the future. And as I mentioned earlier, my next interview will feature a return visit by Jungian analyst Dr. Jeff Raff. And this time, we'll be discussing synchronicity. And hopefully, it won't be a coincidence that you listen to that episode. Until next time, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.